The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
What their interest is in healthcare issues. And everyone who's not a one owl, I have something for.
Everyone who's not a one owl.
I mean, everyone but a one owl, the one owl, I have something for.
The two owls and three owls.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Make it real tricky.
Well, I would like to thank you both for being here. I'm
very welcome.
Salsa and was part of the committee. So I would like to introduce you to Ms. Lilia Trujillo. She came and did us a favor. She's working with the Department of
Health and Human Services.
Health and Human Services. And then we also have Ms. Dorado Valenzuela from Hedel Petone Murphy Block.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, great. So we welcome you and thank you both.
Thank you very much. Okay, so let's just continue with where you were asked to, what people's interests, et cetera, were. Right, if you could tell us your names and what law school you're from and what year you are. And I've already gone that with you three, but you may want to do it really fast.
Okay.
And then share what your interest is in health law or healthcare access issues. And we'll start over here. The gentleman here.
My name is Manny Alvarez. I'm from
My name is Dora LaSalle, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Hedel, Petone, Murphy, and Bach. What we primarily do is professional liability defense. And in that regard, we represent hospitals, institutions, doctors, different healthcare professionals who are being sued for malpractice. I certainly don't have a medical background. I didn't have any type of medical background, for that matter. After law school, I clerked for about 3 years and then ended up at this firm. Interestingly enough, the firm, other than support staff, is primarily non-Latino, and for that matter, I'm the only Latina there. And not surprisingly, in New York City, a vast majority of the litigants, the plaintiffs, are actually of Latino background, which I think presents me in certain situations with a different perspective as to different obstacles that they might have faced in their ability to otherwise follow up or access certain healthcare services. And in that respect, sometimes I try to bring that out or just, you know, make sure that certain elements of that are not necessarily overlooked. With respect to the access to healthcare issues, you know, the fact is that racial disparities exist in all forms in our society today, and we would be otherwise foolish to believe that they don't exist in healthcare. They do, and over the past, you know, 2 decades or so, numerous studies have been conducted which indicate time and time again that minorities or people of color often receive different quality of care in the medical setting for different reasons. One reason, and perhaps one of the more important reasons, in my own opinion, is the ability to access medical insurance, especially for Latinos. The fact is that with respect to medical insurance, not only is it unbelievably expensive if you're trying to access it yourself, but also depending on the situation, you may or may not be able to qualify for public insurance. For example, especially for the working poor, because you're working, you might not qualify for public insurance. But then, at the same time, your employer might not necessarily provide medical insurance. And because the costs are so exuberant, and there is no control over, or no governmental control, really, over how much a hospital institution or physician may charge you for uninsured patients, that more often than not, many people, and you know, I speak specifically about Latinos, we just go without seeking medical care until... you know, unfortunately something happens, and on more than one occasion you're otherwise caught in a situation where you're seeking your primary care from the emergency room, as opposed to seeing a regular physician who follows up and provides continuity of care, monitors your chronic illnesses on an ongoing basis. You know, you just go, bam, when something happens, and at that point, many times there's very little that can be done to remedy a situation or an illness or a disease that has been progressing for, you know, years, months, whatever the case may be. So in terms of being able to access medical insurance, that, in my own opinion, is perhaps one of the greater obstacles that Latinos today face. Everything, meaning it is social, it's political, it's cultural. Culturally, I think many Latinos just defer to their physicians on more than one occasion, perhaps, and, as opposed to taking it upon themselves and realizing that physicians, as with most medical providers, they're human beings, and unfortunately they do make mistakes also. But you yourself as an individual have to have some level of involvement of your own. You know, you owe a duty to yourself, if no one else, to follow through with your own medical care. And that often means that you ask questions. You know, many times, for whatever reason, Latinos may not ask as many questions as, in all honesty, for example, their white counterparts. You know, they're told you have X, Y, and Z, these are the alternatives, and they're given perhaps a piece of paper with some instructions and some basic information, and they don't take it upon themselves to seek out additional information. If you don't understand something, if a doctor didn't explain something to you adequately, ask again and seek second opinions. Find out what risks what health risks you're at risk of experiencing yourself, and what available alternatives you have in terms of maintaining a healthy lifestyle. Those are all things that as individuals we can all do ourselves, and taking an active role in our own health care. With respect to the political environment, I think that legislatures, to some extent, because they're all elected, we should advocate or push towards affordable health care. The fact is that, you know, for those of us who can vote, we elect these legislators, all of who get health insurance after they're elected. Yet we're not, in many instances, not requiring them to provide the same to the communities that they were elected to serve.
Now, can I answer my own question?
Can I interject?
Go ahead.
Okay. I agree with large portions of what you said. However, I'd like to add, there's a couple of things, and I will get into more detail in my presentation because my focus is macro policy from the federal agency that administers the single largest two programs of healthcare services in the country. And Henry, fundamentally, what we're facing, and I think why a lot of you are in the room, has to do with this fact. Healthcare has been commoditized or is treated as a commodity. It used to be that physicians and nurses and other healthcare providers were in a profession of serving. And healthcare is now a profit industry. The agency that I represent pays $400 billion a year for healthcare, either through what's called federal financial participation or directly in Medicare. That doesn't count the money that is expended by private insurers. This is just the federal sector paying money. And what we've seen over the past 20 years, not that I've seen it personally because I'm not that old, but in looking at the trends, what has happened is that it used to be large-scale providers of care, hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, home health agencies, and others who were in, quote-unquote, the helping professions, were nonprofits. If they were organized in not a corporate, but in a business structure, it was in a nonprofit structure which emphasized delivery of care. When you're organized as a nonprofit, you're not looking at the bottom line. What you're looking at is your requirement to serve the public good, and you're expending your quote-unquote profits into delivery of care. What we've seen is hospitals have now gone for-profit. We've also seen skilled nursing facilities and other major providers of care go for-profit. We've seen pharmaceuticals have now taken over the medical profession in large part, and they're driven once again by profit. And what that means is that instead of there being an emphasis on the delivery of care and expansion of access to care, quality care, we've seen instead a premium placed on constricting supply while increasing demand. And if you look at your basic economics, you know what that means. If you constrict supply and you increase demand, you're going to increase price. And because healthcare is what's called inelastic, people need healthcare, whether it's primary care or emergency care or catastrophic care, they're going to pay top dollar, all the while certain folks are going to be completely squeezed out of the market because they're just not competitive, and we know that's disproportionately going to be poor people. It's disproportionately going to be people of color, and particularly English language learners, whether they be white, black, brown, Asian, are going to be the most adversely impacted because they, of course, have the least buying power. So there's going to be the least amount of emphasis and value placed on providing them the care. So you've actually hit it on the head. We have a problem. We've transitioned from a delivery model that has been premised on a nonprofit business structure to a for-profit structure at the same time that we've had a complete disintegration of an agenda geared towards universal access, which a lot of times may mean the type of medicine that you see in Canada or in England, which has been rejected out of hand. And so if we're really serious about providing access and quality, then we have to look at the way that we are currently funding healthcare, because that affects the actual delivery of care and the quality of it.
So let me restate that. It seems to me that the problem we're facing is the utter lack of leadership at the top to articulate a rationale that it is in everyone's self-interest that there be a healthy population. Because whether you're a person of color, rich or poor, that you're working for, we're an integrated society. We're physically integrated, we're socially integrated. I mean, we interact with one another from top to bottom. Certified butlers and maids and cooks and chefs and chauffeurs and drivers, and health is a universal problem. No one can avoid cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't strike by color, age, gender, or otherwise, and all these diseases are common to the human condition. And until we change that model with the leadership at the top saying, it's in my own self-interest in a pragmatic level to see that my neighbors are as healthy as I'd like to be, because the risk is what we're seeing right now. We see hepatitis B, we see all these diseases, HIV, all these things moving through the society. Bird flu is on its way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just going to interject.
All kinds of diseases out there, all driven by the profit model. And it seems to me we need leadership to articulate an alternative model of caring in our own self-interest that the rest of society be healthy.
I was going to interject one thing. I work for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and since I didn't start my presentation, I didn't give my disclaimer, which is, I am not here representing the views of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I am here representing my views as Sylvia Trujillo. However, if you're a 2L and I'm doing recruitment, I am here. But yes, you're absolutely right.
I lied earlier, and I actually do have one burning issue.
Okay.
Would you rather that I wait until the end?
No, feel free.
Okay. And again, please, if my ignorance is down, forgive me. It seems to me that a lot of people are lacking health insurance because they can't afford premiums. I've also met a good number of physicians or former physicians who actually had to get out of the profession because, let's say specialists, for example, they could no longer afford insurance premiums. It also seems that it's easy for insurance companies to pass the buck and point to rising incidence of tortious liability or tortious claims. Now, I guess my question is twofold. One, is it actually true that that the incidence of tortious claims against professionals has risen dramatically? And two, if that is the case, what do you see as the solution to strike a balance between affordable premiums for both patients and physicians or specialists? At the same time, leaving open that avenue for truly negligent healthcare.
I would like to start. Actually, I think there's a widespread misperception out there that, in fact, the premiums of specialists, particularly OBGYNs, have been driven by frivolous lawsuits or litigious claimants or patients who are out to get their doctors. The fact of the matter is the incidence of lawsuits initiated by claimants has been relatively steady. What has changed and the reason why premiums have increased is that insurers invest their premiums in the bond market. And there's an inverse relationship. When the bond market is weak, then premiums increase. And the reason premiums increase is because the returns on the bond market are less for the insurers. And as you know, with the interest rates being what they have been, the bond market has been exceptionally weak for many years. On the flip side, when the bond market is really strong, we see insurers then decrease premiums because they don't need to recoup their losses off their bond market investments. And so, in fact, this has been widely written about and widely acknowledged. However, there's this subterfuge that, in fact, it's plaintiff's, you know, bar that represents malpractice or individuals in malpractice lawsuits that are driving these catastrophic increases in the premiums, when in fact everybody, you know, nods and winks and they realize that it really has something to do with our economic structure currently with regard to the bond market and interest rates.
Can I follow up really quickly?
Sure.
How much transparency then is there between, well, I guess,
just hanging on that, I was going to actually ask a similar question at the end, because in Washington there's two initiatives, one sponsored by doctors and nurses and the other sponsored by lawyers. Doctors and nurses and practitioners to cap the amount, to have patients sign a waiver that says I waive my right to a jury, to a trial, and that a cap of remedies would be about $350,000. And then there's the one by the lawyers that, you know, is trying to not do that. So, yeah, I just think it was interesting. I don't know if other states are kind of seeing the same stuff, but...
Well, I mean, there's the widespread tort reform that has been, you know, talked about, but the reality is, you know, in practice, and what I primarily assist in is the defense of doctors and hospitals, you will always have frivolous actions that make their way through. And the reality is that as you progress, they weed themselves out from those that are meritorious. So to argue or to say that those meritorious cases should be capped at a specific dollar amount because of other individuals who may or may not have a meritorious claim, just in all honesty, just isn't fair. And personally, though, you know, we often assist in defending doctors or hospitals, it's not fair. And many a time, especially when you have an injured infant, the dollar amount that will be expended over the lifetime of that infant to care for will well exceed, you know, $300,000.
And then who ultimately pays for it are the taxpayers, mm-hmm. because then either the taxpayers or they don't get the care. And when we resume our presentations, one of the things I want to talk about are, you know, the differences between Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP, what are some of the global trends in terms of financing of healthcare, the uninsured and federally qualified health centers, and what role do lawyers play and how does that interplay with access?
I know, I was going to tell you, do you want to start with that? Because I
sure.
had some comments on that too, but since you're actually more involved with
okay.
it, you can probably pick
well,
up there.
I'm with the Office of the General Counsel, and my client is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but I also represent other agencies within the U.S. Department of Health and Services, including the agency that administers grant funds to federally qualified health centers. And that's going to be relevant to the discussion, and Henry actually segued us really nicely into that, and that's the issue of access. And access is frequently driven by ability to pay for those services. And as we have seen, the way that we as a nation have elected to pay for services is through three essential avenues, either through government payment, and the federal government is the single largest government entity that pays for services. Under Medicare. Medicare is directly administered by the federal government. It's for those 65 years and older, as well as individuals with certain conditions like end-stage renal disease. The other program for which the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services provides oversight but does not administer is the Medicaid program. The federal government provides oversight and also provides what's called federal financial participation, which is matching funds. Medicaid is administered by states, and it's typically for individuals with children who meet certain income eligibility levels. If you've seen one Medicaid state plan, you've seen one state Medicaid plan. They're all different. They have a core set of requirements, but they're essentially... States are allowed a substantial amount of leeway in developing their coverage determinations, the types of services, who they'll cover, We also grant waivers with regard to expansion populations. But the short and long of it is when you think about Medicaid, it's going to only serve those individuals with nearly no assets. You can only have about $2,000 of assets on hand. That includes a value of a house, your car, your money in the bank. So, for example, my mother, who for a period of time before she was eligible for Medicare, did not have any health insurance, and we were paying premiums and monthly, and they went from $255 to $675 to over $1,000 a month. However, my mom was not eligible for Medicaid because she had a home, and the value of that home, well, there's a major caveat to that. We could have qualified her for Medicaid. However, what would have happened is any costs incurred during the course of providing her services would have resulted in a lien on her home. She could have lived in her home for her lifetime, and then upon her death, the home would be sold, and then any balance that was owed for services provided via Medicaid would be used to bring down that balance. And it probably would, with the cost of health care, completely wipe out the value of the home. So Medicaid is for individuals who have very little to no assets on hand. Also, 9 times out of 10, you also have to have children in order to be eligible for Medicaid. Medicare for individuals who are 65 years and older.
So Medicare is without financial qualification?
There's no financial qualification. Everybody qualifies for Medicare. When you turn 65, you're eligible for Medicare.
So what happens? I retire 20 years, I turn 65, and I have a lifetime medical plan through my retirement program, and I work with the government, the state government.
Then there's an answer to that.
Okay.
Medicare is always secondary to another insurer. So if you are otherwise insured, then Medicare, you're eligible for Medicare, but if there's some other insurer, then Medicare is always going to be the secondary. So if there's another insurer, they always pay primary to Medicare. So there's government funding for certain categories of individuals, right? And those are insurance programs. And they're somewhat comprehensive, but they ensure primary care access as well as emergency care access. And the coverage varies, particularly if you're talking about Medicaid, but essentially they're decent insurance coverage programs, as far as insurance coverage programs go. States also have some additional programs. They're called expansion populations, or they may expand the level of eligibility so that you don't have to be completely impoverished to qualify for some services. Also, some localities. So, for example, the District of Columbia has an insurance program that they fund for everyone who's at 200% of the poverty level, and you don't have to have children, and you qualify for primary care access as well as some emergent services, okay? So there's the federal government, then there's private insurers, which most people are typically insured via their employer who contracts with insurers to provide them coverage. And then last, there's payment without insurance. So those who are not covered have no insurance, that's out of pocket. Let me be clear. Those are medical malpractice insurance carriers.
Yes. Oh, medical malcarriers.
Right.
They invest in the bond market.
Right.
But typical health insurance carriers?
No.
Is different.
Right.
Okay. Well,
that could be very different. I mean,
let me ask my question anyway. Has anyone considered the public utility model where the private sector is guaranteed a return in return for their near monopolistic control over some activity? Why couldn't some of the insurance carriers, I mean, the system is absolutely out of control.
That sounds like managed care.
So much for something. I had cancer, I recovered from that, and I was tested for 15 million things that I didn't need to be tested for, but because of the fear of malpractice exposure, they over-test, over-exam.
Or it also might
be... It's so wasteful. But so why wouldn't a utility model
We do have that kind of model. It's called managed care. It's a capitated system where basically you say, and just to go back to Medicaid, for example, Medicaid, each state can contract with a managed care organization and say, we're going to give you this rate of reimbursement on a monthly basis for this beneficiary. And if you come in under, if the cost of the services you provide is under this amount, you get to keep the profit. So it incentivizes them to keep the cost down.
But also keep people healthy.
Right, and that's the rub, right, is that with any managed care model, you run the risk of creating an incentive to decrease the level of service so that you can maximize your profit. And so that's why you have a lot of resistance from folks who look at managed care models who are concerned. I mean, you all heard the horror stories. Someone is in a managed care system, let's say, not to pick on Kaiser, but people are familiar with Kaiser. You know, it's a common name. And you need a referral to a specialist. And let's say that your primary care provider determines that you aren't manifesting the symptoms that would trigger the obligation on their part to make a referral to the specialist. And so there's an appeals process that you can go through within a managed care organization. But it's very similar, that basically you give a monopoly over a group of individuals who elect to participate in this program. If they want to go outside of this program, then they have to do it out of pocket. So it incentivizes people to stay within. And then it gives a flat rate to keep the cost down, and it should, you know, ensure that the price overall remains low. So we have attempted those models, and the real, I think, solution is universal health care. I mean, we keep trying to play a game of making health care for profit. And when we look at, I'm going to put on another hat, which is before I started working in our central office, I started in our regional office, and most of the work that I did was enforcement. And I worked on defending my client, which would take enforcement actions against skilled nursing facilities and home health agencies that provided substandard care to the elderly. And what would happen is there's a system for going in, evaluating whether certain standards have been met. And if they haven't been met, my client can levy civil money penalties, they can impose managers, they can deny them certification to have trainees come in and receive their certification through that process. Also, we can terminate them, which is the death knell from the Medicare program, and ultimately it's termination from the Medicaid program. And in the course of defending my client in those enforcement actions, because there are appeal rights that those providers have when we are going to terminate them or fine them, we often saw a pattern. And those facilities that had the best care were nonprofit. And those facilities that had the worst care were for-profit. Now, why is that not surprising? I mean, it makes perfect sense. And all the while that we're devising new ways to put a cap on runaway costs of healthcare costs have been growing exponentially every year. The federal government is spending more and more every year on Medicare, even without the prescription drug benefit, which just went through, which basically will bankrupt our generation. Medicaid is wiping out the coffers of states across the nation. It's only going to get worse, and the reason it's only going to get worse is because the federal government has now said they're going to cut $10 billion in Medicaid funding. Well, the federal government provides at least 50% in federal matching funds to every state in Medicaid money. So the question is, with costs increasing for Medicaid, where is the money going to come from? It's going to come from the general revenue fund streams of every state. Well, states are already calling foul. So they said, we can't finance health care. It's too expensive. And so what I do now involves defending the secretary when the secretary is drug in to lawsuits initiated against states by beneficiaries who are challenging state policy decisions to terminate coverage of certain types of care, needed care, but care that states can no longer afford to fund. And so the federal government gets drug in, and we're not properly a party, so my job is to get us out of it. But the upshot of it is that what we've seen is what was relatively rare, which were these lawsuits that we would get drug into, we're starting to see an incremental increase as more and more states have started to cut back on coverage for care, and beneficiaries are suing, and they're sometimes winning. And when they win, I'll give you an example in Tennessee. Tennessee went across the board and tried to cut all kinds of funding under Medicaid, or all kinds of coverage. And federal courts came in and said under 1983 law, absolutely not. Under the Medicaid statute, you are required to fund these essential services, and you cannot curtail them, even if you're experiencing financial distress. So Tennessee, their program, their Medicaid program is called TennaCare, a year ago told the federal government, Medicaid is a voluntary program. We don't have to participate in this program. The only reason we do is because we receive federal financial funds that help us pay for care to our population, but we can't pay our portion of it anymore. And with these federal court orders, we're getting out of Medicaid. So we have a very serious problem. Medicaid serves the most vulnerable populations we have. Under the Medicare Modernization Act, when it was initially proposed, we knew that the pharmaceutical companies would bankrupt the Medicare program because the costs are so prohibitive. And they're prohibitive not because it's costly to produce pharmaceuticals. It's because they have patents. Mm-hmm. And because of the patents, you can't replicate it with other suppliers or producers for a set period of time. Your insurance company or Costco can go to a pharmaceutical and say, I'm going to buy in bulk for a group, and I want you to give me a discount. The pharmaceutical, in order to make a bulk sale, will sell to you for a discount. Guess who doesn't get to do that? The single largest category of healthcare consumers paid for by your eventual tax dollars, if you're not already taxpaying, which is Medicare. Under the Medicare Modernization Act, the CMS administrator publicly told folks that the only way to hold down healthcare costs was to negotiate with pharmaceuticals group discounts for the single largest group of consumers in the nation. So what did Congress do? They did the obvious thing to save us money, right? They said that Medicare could go in and negotiate group discounts on pharmaceuticals for Medicare beneficiaries.
Yeah.
Wrong.
What happened?
Not only did Congress not have that provision in that piece of legislation, Congress affirmatively said that my client agency is precluded from negotiating bulk discounts with pharmaceuticals, so that the single largest buyer of pharmaceuticals for beneficiaries is prohibited from doing what private insurers and HMOs are allowed to do. And there's one big group of people that we're not talking about that disproportionately affects our community, and that's the uninsured. And I mentioned nonprofits, and I said that the nonprofit model is a more functional model for the delivery of care than a for-profit model. Well, that isn't always the case. And the problem is this, and this may be a point of interest if you guys have third-year projects and you eventually decide you're interested in healthcare. But there is a Latino advocacy organization out of California that has worked in conjunction with a set of plaintiff side lawyers from throughout the nation, and they've sued a series of nonprofit hospitals. And the reason that they've sued nonprofit hospitals is that they charge list prices, non-discounted prices, to the uninsured. Mm-hmm. The uninsured are the only individuals, they're the only consumers of healthcare who pay list price. Everybody else pays discounts. Mm-hmm. So when we passed the bankruptcy law, which I think you may be all familiar with, that recently passed, it was very controversial.
As of October 17th, I think it was.
It's effective. The reason it was so controversial is because the three most common reasons people file for bankruptcy are divorce, which can be catastrophic financially, business failure, which can also be catastrophic, and three, hospitalization. Being hospitalized can result in bankruptcy for most Americans. It's not credit card bills. It's those three things. And so the individuals who are declaring bankruptcy are the uninsured who pay list price for emergency care and for hospitalization. And so when we look at the whole issue of we have a problem with our public funding model, when we look at Medicare and Medicaid, we already know that we have problems. With Medicare, the prescription drug benefit that just passed is a problem because it's going to bankrupt us, because we're not allowing the federal agencies to negotiate discounts on drugs, and drugs are the most expensive part of the delivery of care. For Medicaid, we already have seen the federal government has indicated they want to cut $10 billion because, as you know, we're running major deficits, and so they're looking to save money. That means that states are obliged to use that funding from their general funds, which means there's less money for roads and education. Three, we also have seen the incidence of the under and uninsured increase exponentially, despite all the best efforts to try to provide greater care. And with those greater numbers of uninsured, we're going to see greater incidences of bankruptcy and other problems such as the spread of disease, both chronic and pandemics. For example, the avian flu. So the short and long of it is knowing about healthcare funding models, knowing about quality of care and access to care, is helpful if you go into private practice and represent the private industry. And it's also helpful to know if you're interested in quality of care issues and access to care issues, particularly to the most vulnerable in our society.
Well, I just wanted to add, as was mentioned, often there is, as I mentioned earlier, there's also no regulation as to what either nonprofit or private hospitals can charge uninsured patients. And with Medicare and Medicaid, as Sylvia mentioned, Medicare is administered federally. And in doing so, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, the fee schedules are calculated based on a national methodology, as opposed to with states who individually set their own fee rates. So what happens practically, and this is just from my own experience, is that we end up with a somewhat two-tiered
reimbursement
model, where those who, for example, I can only speak as to New York. In New York, typically, a Medicare patient who goes in for a comprehensive doctor's visit, that doctor will often be reimbursed up to six times more so than a Medicaid patient. And it's not a matter of, you know, one person being 65 or over or very disabled and the other one being poor, but there is a disparity in the reimbursement rates, and as a result, many hospitals, many doctors create this two-tiered system of healthcare as well, where for those who have insurance, you're seen by faculty practices. And those are often the more experienced physicians, the facilities that have the better equipment, et cetera, whereas those who are either uninsured or publicly insured end up at clinics. And these clinics often, whether we know it or not, are not staffed by physicians. Often they're being staffed by physician's assistants or nurse practitioners. And for many people, you walk in, you see the white lab coat, you otherwise assume you're being treated by a physician when in fact you're not. And for that matter, sometimes the physician may not even be on premises. It's just a matter of an on-call physician. And in that affects the quality of health care that people are receiving, and disproportionately, they are people of color, and they are Latinos, because we are more likely than not to not be insured or have public insurance as opposed to our non-minority counterparts.
And one last thing, the federal government also funds federally qualified health centers, which if you're underinsured or uninsured, you can go to a federally qualified health center. And they're funded through what's called Section 3 Public Health Act funds, administered by one of the agencies I represent. And unfortunately, as part of the agenda of this administration, they were to increase funding to federally qualified health centers for purposes of expanding care to those who are under or uninsured. The reality is that because of the distress that states are experiencing as a result of the squeeze on Medicaid, federally qualified health centers, which also serve Medicaid patients, are being adversely impacted financially as well, because they're seeing fewer dollars, Medicaid dollars, which means that the other funds that were supposed to expand the populations that were being served are actually being siphoned off to subsidize the provision of care to Medicaid patients. What this means for us is that Section 330 grant funds are administered by an agency that has very serious underrepresentation of Latinos.
And what that means is when those grants are awarded, Latinos are at a distinct disadvantage because those agencies that provide care, like Casa de Maryland and others that may be competing for those funds, are not going to receive the consideration that they should receive. And by that I mean this. On the East Coast, my experience has been, anecdotally, there's a black-white paradigm with regard to being underserved or a community that has faced historic lack of services, which has meant that in order to reach parity in grant funds, we've really struggled to educate not only Caucasian colleagues, but colleagues who are African-American about the needs of the Latino community. That's important. We need to do that because the Latino community is obviously one of the largest and fastest growing minority communities around the country, not simply on the West Coast or in the Southwest or in Texas. And for that reason, one of the other healthcare disparities that we face is not simply on the front line. It doesn't mean that we can simply fix the problem by figuring out how do we get access to folks on the ground. Part of the problem is that there's a lot of misconceptions and lack of information on the policy level about what the needs are of our community, which is my pitch to you, since all of you are too old, that I hope you really consider public service, one, because I think part of the problem with healthcare is that it's a profit-driven model and there's not an emphasis on public service. But two, that you certainly consider, if you're at all interested in human services or healthcare, federal service in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, because all the issues that we talked about, you deal with. If you want to do policy work, you can go in on the policy side and work on those issues. Or if you want to represent various agencies, you can do that as a lawyer, and we really need you. Our voices need to be heard. And the beauty of federal service is that you're not just helping one particular community. Frequently, the policies and initiatives and litigation you impact cover whole regions, and it may be a whole state, and oftentimes we're talking about four or five states, and not infrequently we're talking about the whole country. International jurisdiction. But what a universal model would look like is taking Medicare, which is a program administered by the federal government, and, well, frankly, for lack of a better word, it's socialized medicine, which means the federal government takes over the administration of the healthcare program, where hospitals and doctors are paid by the federal government.
And they're all paid the same rates.
Right. Well, right. Yes. And issues with regard to medicine, the federal government's going to negotiate directly with pharmaceuticals. So in Canada, for example, why are prescription drugs in Canada so inexpensive? It's because the national government goes to the pharmaceutical and says, if you want us to distribute this medicine through our network, you have to give us a really big discount. And so they do. So in the context of pharmaceuticals, that's what it means. It means taking the buying power of the nation and bringing it to bear. Now, who ultimately pays for those pharmaceuticals in Canada? The government does. And how is that paid? Through taxpayer dollars. And so what you essentially end up doing is taking general revenue fund or you do a dedicated amount, you could tax people, you know, a health care tax, just like we do a Medicare tax and a Social Security tax. I mean, a portion of our tax, our general revenue, I mean, a certain amount of the tax that you look at and watch your form when you look over what you've been taxed have been dedicated to certain streams of programs. And that's what we could do, and you distribute risk. For young people, they don't need a lot of health care. For older people, they do. But it also means that you start triaging care, which means, as Mr. Barbosa mentioned, that you're not going to get 20 or 30 tests. You're not going to get an MRI every time you go in and you break a leg. That there may be instances where you want specialty care and you're not going to get it. But we have to make a decision. Do we want to make sure everybody has access to primary care and access to emergent care? And then how much are we going to invest in chronic care? Because the really expensive care is chronic care. Chronic care is those conditions that aren't immediately deadly but are ongoing. And a big one in America today is diabetes.
Okay. My question is, to change things within the legislature, how would you suggest going about doing that when you have the power of lobbyists from huge, you know, companies, pharmaceutical companies, and so on and so forth, that really have kind of the connections, networking, and the power to make nothing, you know, have no change done?
The single largest advocacy organization in the country is AARP. And they are incredibly powerful. But they were over, you know, the pharmaceuticals prevailed against them in this whole prescription drug debacle. Having said that, it takes young people coming together in coalitions and understanding the catastrophic effect of not addressing the lack of health care, and also the catastrophic effects to the fiscal vitality of this country of not putting the brakes on expenditures for health care. Because like I said, the prescription drug benefit is catastrophic financially. Well, we will be paying for it. If they do not revise it and take back the prescription drug benefit, there is no way we're going to swim out of this hole. And we will pay for it in terms of either we're not going to have coverage for basic care when we're seniors, or the program will just be gone because we cannot afford to pay for the baby boomers, which is this huge group of people. And we're a much smaller group that we're going to pay for a prescription drug and their health benefits.
At full retail, not at a discount or retail.
Right, the pharmaceuticals, right. And so if an alliance does not come together of concerned people like myself and yourself and people in this room with the AARP and say we need a fundamental rethinking of healthcare in this country, it's not going to happen.
Well, my next question is,
I just wanted to add to what Sylvia said, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the AARP. Just about every state has, you know, quite a few advocacy organizations who are all advocating for the same thing. It takes people to join them to assist them in getting their message out. Take, for example, the education programs we've all read and seen about tobacco or about seatbelt usage. That's all been caught on, and people know about it, and it's taken seriously. Similarly, advocacy for affordable health care or universal health care has to be taken seriously, but it won't be until the message is heard otherwise loud and clear and enough people hear it.
Well, my next question is, how do we get, because like I said, until my mother had a kidney transplant, I didn't know what it was like, the cost or anything like that, of insurance bills, the cost of having to take medications afterwards as a transplant patient. So there must be other people, a huge population out there just like me that doesn't understand it until it hits them. And normally for like me, you know, if I was healthy and my mother was healthy, I wouldn't even know if I was like 40 or 50. Mm-hmm. So how do we access people my age, like get it out there that something needs to be done, not later but now? That seems to be like a huge problem right now. Right.
Well, it's a matter of, yes, getting the message out. And many of the advocacy organizations, you can certainly look into them in your particular states, but many of them do presentations. And we'll come and speak to a group.
So perhaps in terms of people who are in the legal field, you can always invite one of these organizations perhaps to your law school to speak to the law school, because as attorneys, we're more likely than not to find ourselves in positions of either politics or legislation to be able to effectuate some type of change. So whether you independently conduct research and get the message out, or invite some type of advocacy group to come speak to your organization, whether it be in your community, in your law school, your church, whatever the case may be, the fact is that the message, and for that matter the same message, has to be repeated often enough so that people start to identify with it.